think it's important for us to keep our church vision in front of us making sure that we are doing our best to live into our calling as a church. And of course, you're familiar with this, but I wanted to read it with you this morning, reminding you that we are a church family that is growing in the knowledge and the love of God, that we are committed to unity, pursuing godly character, and becoming the hands and feet of Jesus in this community. That's who we are, and that is what we are striving to be. All of that revolves around the theme for this year, which is developing a deeper awareness of God. Several hundred years ago, a bunch of Puritan preachers got together and wrote what is known as the Westminster Shorter Catechism. And this is what they said concerning the purpose of man, as they tried to wrap their heads around what life is all about. Why are we here and what are we supposed to be doing? And the catechism gives a very simple answer to that question. It says, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. I believe they got that right. That our chief aim and purpose in life is to glorify God and enjoy Him. But that is difficult to do if we don't know our God. If we're going to glorify Him, and if we're going to enjoy Him, we need to know Him. And that's why we're in this series of lessons entitled, Allow Me to Introduce Myself. And you see those big letters there. They spell the Hebrew word Yahweh, which is the name of our God. You know, I have a name, you have a name. We give names to our children. We give names to things so that we can identify them, but also so that we can connect to them. Can you remember what it was like for your parents to name your children? Remember that process? How did you come up with the names that you gave your children? Maybe you just leafed through a baby name book. All right, dog-eared, I'll get it right. The pages that had a name on it that you liked. Maybe it was a name that had a particular ring to it. You liked the sound of it and how it flowed, maybe with their middle name and their last name. Maybe it's a family name that you wanted to pass on. I don't know how you came up with the names of your children. Do you know how you got your name and what it means? I hope most of you do. And if you don't, I found an interesting website called names.org. You can visit that website and you can put your name in the search field, and it will bring up all kinds of neat information about your name, all kinds of demographics. Now, don't go there now and do it now. All right, if you want to visit name.org, do it later. But I went through and I plugged in the names of our family. So Adam is pretty well known to be the first name of the Bible, first man in the Bible. It's of Hebrew origin. Anybody know what it means? It means man, or what else? You know the literal translation of Adam? Dirt. My name is Dirt. Or more specifically, red clay. And most people identify that name, of course, with the first man and the leader of mankind. So I put Heather's name in. It's of English origin, and I really like her name. It simply means it's a purple flower from Scotland. In other words, she's as beautiful as she can be. Then I looked up the boys' names. Elijah is Hebrew in origin. Anybody know what Elijah means? Familiar character in the Bible? Elijah, do you know what your name means? It means, my God is Yahweh. Or, the Lord is my God. Seth's name is also of Hebrew origin. Seth, his name, anybody know what it means? Appointed by God. Of course, he was the third child, the third son of Adam and Eve. Looked up Luke's name. Luke's name is English in origin, but its roots are in Koine Greek. We're familiar with Luke because he wrote the Gospel of Luke. He wrote the book of Acts. Does anybody know what Luke means? I was surprised by this one. I did not know. I heard people whisper under their breath. What'd you say, Jim?
Lucas?
From what I could find, it simply means light or the bright one. Interesting names. Names are important to us, but they were more important to those who lived in the era of the Old Testament. In the world of the Hebrew Scriptures, a personal name was often thought to indicate something essential about that person's identity, their origin, their birth circumstances, and maybe even divine purpose for their life. Abraham's name was taken to mean the father of many or the father of multitudes. Isaac's name means laughter. Now, why would it mean laughter? Because when Sarah heard that she was going to conceive and have a child in her old age, what did she do? She laughed about it. Moses, in Exodus chapter 2, verse 10, means to draw out. Because he was drawn out of what? The Nile River. Now, not all of the names in the Bible have a specific or complex origin. Some of them just are names. David means the beloved one. Jacob's first wife, Leah, probably comes from a verb meaning to be weary. Hannah derives from a word that was later translated as grace. But often Hebrew names declare an important theological truth that point us to who God is and what God is doing through that person. For example, Joshua's name means Yahweh is salvation. So names are important in the Bible. They help us identify. More importantly, they help us to connect to someone. What is God's name? Well, you may be surprised to know that it is not God. God is a title that was given to all kinds of gods, even in the Hebrew Bible. It's really a category that means a spiritual being. And so in the Bible, you will have the word Elohim, or El, like El Roy, or El Shaddai. That word, those two first letters, E-L, is a generic term for God Himself. And when we go back to the reading that Aaron had in Exodus chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, we learn something very interesting. God is talking to Moses and telling Moses what his mission is going to be. And he says, I need you to introduce me to the Israelites and tell them that I am the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he says, I am the Lord. The word Lord there is Yahweh. You know that because all of the letters in your English translation are all capitalized. He says, my name is the Lord, and I did not make myself known to them. Are you telling me that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not know God as Yahweh? They did not know Him by His personal name. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, because the word Yahweh does appear several times in the book of Genesis. But it seems as if God mostly interacted with the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, by this generic term of El, or Elohim. Or as in Genesis chapter 17, Abraham knew Him as El Shaddai. You have to remember the world that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the nation of Israel lived in. They were familiar with all kinds of gods and goddesses. As we were reading the book of Leviticus, we got to chapter 17 and verse 7, and something stood out to me, probably because I was preparing this particular sermon, that caught my eye that maybe had never caught my eye before. It says that you should no longer make sacrifices to the goat god. Some translations say goat demons. Who is this goat god? Well, I didn't take the time to jump down that rabbit hole because I probably never would have gotten out of it. But it reveals something. That the Israelites were familiar with all kinds of Elohims, gods and goddesses. That point is borne out even again. Go to Exodus chapter 32. Moses is up on Mount Sinai. He's getting the Ten Commandments, and Aaron and the rest of Israel are down at the foot of the mountain. All right, they've decided that it's taking Moses way too long. They get fed up with him, and so they decide to make their own gods. Aaron collects the gold, throws it into the furnace, and whoops, a golden calf pops out. And what does Aaron say? Did you notice this? He says, these are your gods, plural, that brought you out of slavery in Egypt. The idea of an Elohim was not unfamiliar for the people of Israel. But they needed help narrowing it down. Who is this God, this Elohim, who can bring plagues upon Egypt and bring down one of the mightiest rulers of the day? Who is this God who can divide a sea and allow us to walk through on dry land? What kind of Elohim is he? Well, Moses knows that the people are going to have questions about this. They're going to want to know exactly who this Elohim is. And so when God first appears to Moses and says, listen, I need you to go and rescue the people out of slavery and oppression, Moses begins to give all kinds of excuses as to why he's not the man for the job. And one of his first excuses is, what if they ask me who sent me? Because again, they're familiar with the goat god. They're familiar with the gods of Egypt. Abraham was familiar with the gods of his ancestors. Who is this God? And so God gives Moses an answer. He says, Moses, when they ask who sent you, tell them this. I am sent you. Isn't that a strange way to introduce yourself? I'll walk up to Adam and say, hi, it's nice to meet you. And you are?
I am.
Oh, come on now. That worked better than what I had scripted out in my head. I am, really. How strange would we think that would be? Incredibly strange. Who talks about themselves? Like, I am. Reminds me of the guy behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, right? Don't look behind the curtain. But it goes on. If you look at Exodus chapter 3, that verb there, I am, could simply be translated that way, or it could be translated, I will be what I will be. Well, I'm sure that wasn't going to clear a lot up for the people of Israel. And so he needed a little more than that. So if you go back to Exodus chapter 3, he not only says, I am who I am, but he says, thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent you. God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, the Lord, or Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent you, or sent me to you. Yahweh. Now, it's true that the word Elohim or El is used to refer to all kinds of gods and goddesses, even within the Hebrew Scriptures. If you looked at Baal, he was referred to as El. But Yahweh, it's unique. No other god in the Bible is referred to as Yahweh. God is giving us a self-revelation. He is telling us about something about himself that we need to know. And if we're going to understand the name of God that was given to Moses, we need to know a little bit about the story of Moses' own life. So let's back up all the way to the very beginning of the book of Exodus. And we're going to do kind of an overview of the life of Moses to help us understand who Yahweh is. Now you remember that Moses was born into slavery. As an Israelite, he is born into the land of Egypt, probably around the 19th dynasty, at a time when the entire nation has been forced into slave labor. Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 through 10, tells us that the Egyptian leader grows concerned about these resident refugees, that they might form an alliance with hostile powers and thereby threaten to overthrow Pharaoh and his regime. And so Pharaoh cooks up this idea. How are we going to control these slaves so that they don't overwhelm us? Well, he begins by inflicting upon them what? Death. He tells the midwives that when you go to deliver an Israelite baby and it's a boy, you're to do what? Throw him into the Nile. In essence, feed him to the crocodiles. Infanticide. We'll control the population through death. That didn't work because the midwives feared God. We'll try a second strategy. We'll impose upon them hard labor. We'll make their lives so miserable that they won't have the time, the energy, or the desire to continue growing. Of course, both of those schemes fail. And then Moses himself is rescued from a grim fate because his mother saw that he was special and wanted to spare his life. And so she builds an ark. And by the way, there's only two times that word ark appears, all right, in the Bible. Here and in Genesis chapter 6, 7, 8, and 9, Noah's ark. Of course, this is a lot smaller. But it's interesting how the language is used. The ark is used as a way of redemption, a way of rescue, a way of God stepping into the world and using it as a vessel to renew his creation. It just happened to be that a member of the Egyptian royal family, the daughter of Pharaoh, was nearby on the riverside that day, and she sees this abandoned little boy. And she picks the baby up and makes it her own, adopts him into the royal family. And it just happened to be that Moses' mother just happened to be close by. And she's hired on to be the Moses' nurse. And so by a strange twist of fate, this slave-born child grows up as the adopted grandson of the very ruler who would have had him killed. Now, Moses grows up, and we don't know how this came about. We don't know if he was just curious or his mother taught him, but he knew something about his origin. He knew he was not an Egyptian, but that he was an Israelite. And one day he goes out and he maybe is just trying to spend some time with those of his own nation and country. I'm not exactly sure, but he sees a slave being beaten and he decides that he needs to intercede to do something about it. So he steps between the slave and the slave master, and he's unable to resolve the disputes. And so he resorts to what? To violence. He kills the Egyptian and hides the body in the sand. The next day he goes out again, and this time he encounters two Israelites fighting with one another. And once again, he intervenes, but the secret is out. He's not a friend, but an enemy. And the Israelite speaks up and says, "So who died and made you king? Are you going to kill me too?" So to the Egyptians, Moses had become an Israelite, but to the Israelites, he was still an Egyptian. Pharaoh's after him, and now so are his own people. So what's he to do? Well, he runs. He runs to Midian. He flees into exile. Having rejected a royal heritage for the cause of justice, he finds himself among his own people being rejected. And he turns and he meets a priest of Midian and he marries one of his daughters. And at this point, when it all seems lost, Moses' life takes an unexpected turn. Here he is, fallen from grace in the royal family, rejected by his own people, now nothing more than a lowly shepherd to a Midianite priest. Some would think that he had failed utterly. And then one day, while he's tending the flock, he sees something unusual, brilliant, amazing. A bush that is burning but yet not being consumed. Curiosity gets the best of him, and he goes to investigate, and he hears a voice from this bush that says, "Take your sandals off, because what? You are standing on holy ground." And then this voice identifies itself. It says, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Wonder why he hid his face. Maybe it was because he was very aware of his own failures, his own guilt, and maybe he hid his face out of shame. Moses responds to the voice. After he's given instructions to go and to give the Israelites freedom, he says, "If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" And that's when God reveals his name. "Tell them that I am Yahweh. I am who I am, or I will be who I will be." Yahweh is the one name that Scripture uses for the God of Israel and for no other. It is the one name by which God's essential identity and way of acting with the people of Israel will be known for all time. Notice what it says in Exodus 3 and verse 15. "This is my name forever, and this is my title for all generations." God is revealing himself to his people. No longer just Elohim. He's no longer just El Shaddai or El Roy. He is Yahweh. Fast forward. God uses Moses to deliver the people of Egypt. They escape the Egyptians. They make their way to Mount Sinai. God invites them to the mount so he can introduce himself to everybody there, and they're like, "No, we're only going to get so close. Moses, why don't you go up and talk to him? We'll stay here." So Moses goes up on the mount, and of course we know the story of the golden calf. We know of Moses coming down and breaking the Ten Commandments and having to go back up and talk to God. And it's there that God is angry with the people of Israel. And he's like, "You know what? I've had enough of these people. You know what I'll do, Moses? I'll just start over with you." Amazing thing happens. God is convinced to change his mind. Moses intercedes for the people. He pleads with God. He says, and God relinquishes and he says, "My presence will go with you, and I will" what? "Give you rest." God does not abandon his people. I think there's an important point to highlight here. The message that God intends to convey is that my presence will go with you wherever you go. And it's not just a passive presence, it's not inert. It's an active and saving presence, a presence that makes following him possible and leads to what? Rest. I don't know about you, but especially in the world that we live in today, I long for rest. peace, tranquility. And we can look in all kinds of places for that rest. But it's only found in one place. In the presence and in the name of God. He goes on to introduce himself. He not only says in Exodus chapter 34, when Moses asked to see God face to face, he says, no, you can't see me face to face, but I'll hide you in the cleft of the rock and pass, and you can look over and see my back. He says this, though, the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. What is he telling Moses and telling us? Well, it suggests that God's goodness and God's name are very much connected to his glory. He's saying, I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy to whom I will show mercy. God is gracious and merciful simply because that is God's nature. God's name reveals who he is and what kind of God he is. And he wants us to know him as being a personal God. A lot of people talk about God having a personal relationship with him. And I think that might be helpful in one sense and not helpful in another. The God of Israel certainly is not a personal God in the sense that one might have a personal account or a personal trainer in order to meet some personal need. That's not it at all. Israel's God is personal in the sense of being consistently interested in people. He loves people. He loves you. He wants to know you. And he's willing to do whatever it takes so that you can know him and he can know you. Fascinates me that God is willing to even go out on a limb and have dialogue, an intimate conversation with mere mortals. And yet he does over and over and over again. What does Yahweh, what does this revelation about God reveal to us? A couple of quick points. Number one, the name Yahweh is forever attached to what God is doing in the book of Exodus. The revelation of the name is attached to the liberation of God's people. When people who are oppressed, who are marginalized, call out for help, God hears their voice. Yahweh's character is not just revealed in his name. It is revealed in how he moves and acts within the story. God's name, yes, is Yahweh. But to know his name is to know not only who he is, but what he is all about. What he is up to in the world. God wants to bring liberation, freedom to people. Also, knowing Yahweh helps us identify who we are as humans. That we have a part in the divine purpose. That we have a part in God's mission for the world. That he did not make us and then just leave us to our own devices. No, he has called us to be partners with him. And so it's a call to obedience. Knowing God and knowing God truly lies at the heart of living a faithful life. The more you know him, the more faithful you will want to be. Because you know that he is leading you into the abundant life. He is leading you into the ways of righteousness. And that knowing him is about experiencing his love. Do me a favor, turn over to the New Testament, because one of the goals of this series of lessons is to draw everything back to Jesus. In John chapter 17, we're very familiar with Jesus's, we call it his high priestly prayer. But I want you to notice some of the things that Jesus says In John chapter 17 and verse 6, he says, I have made your name known to those whom you gave me from the world. They were yours and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. So when a Israelite, a Pharisee, a Sadducee would have heard this, when they heard Jesus use the word name there, they would have immediately drawn back to Old Testament language and stories. Jesus says, Father, I have made known to you, or to your people, your name. Look at the end of the chapter. Chapter 17, verse 25. Righteous Father, the world does not know you, but I know you. And these know that you have sent me. I have made your name known to them, and I will make it known so that the love with which you have loved me may be in them and I in them. Why does God want us to know his name? So that we can experience the love that God has, not only for us, but for his Son. You know, it's hard for us to wrap our minds around a infinite God. We struggle with trying to understand who he is. And we often think that this God is untouchable, that he is so far above us, that he is high and holy, and that we just cannot reach out and actually know him or even touch him. And sometimes that causes us to have an extreme fear of him. But God doesn't want you to fear him in the sense of trembling, being frightened, scared, unable to approach him, to commune with him, to have fellowship with him. There's this tension in the Bible that God is high and holy, and yet at the same time, he's right here with us. He's a friend. And it's hard for us to maintain that tension. And often what we do when we experience tension in life is that we want to eradicate tension, right? We want to get rid of it. More often in life, what we need to do is manage tension rather than eradicate it. The whole God as being high and holy, and yet at the same time, a dear, close friend and father. I may have told you this story before, but I keep it in my mind often. And I think you should too. So I'm going to tell you again. Ray Tilley was one of the elders at the North Beckley Church of Christ. I had an enormous, and still do, amount of respect and love for that man. He was one of the first elders that really shepherded me, not only as a preacher, but as a brother, as a fellow disciple. We were talking one day at lunch, which we often had, and he was telling me about his view of God. And we both grew up in a culture where God was something to be afraid of, in the sense that you wanted to hide from him, that you were just afraid that at any moment God was going to strike you dead. And Ray wanted to eradicate that vision of God within our church. And so we often spoke about how he viewed God. And he would often tell the congregation this. He would ask them, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get to heaven? I'll ask you, what's the first thing you're going to do when you get to heaven? First thing. You thought about it? Now, we've all thought about that question. What's the first thing you're going to do? For me, I'm going to look for my son. I'm going to look for my grandparents. I'm going to give them a hug and tell them I love them. Sometimes we get silly with the question. I'm going to find Adam and Eve and find out if they really did have belly buttons or not. Or maybe we find somebody like Elijah and ask what it was like to be caught up in a whirlwind and chariot of fire. We've got all these questions that we want. Ray said, I don't want to do any of that. I mean, I'll get to that kind of stuff. But the first thing I'm going to do is I am going to walk into the throne room of God. And the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to bow before the Father. Because he is Lord and Master, creator of all things. He has all power and authority. And I'm going to prostrate myself before his throne, and I'm going to worship him. And he said, here's the second thing I'm going to do, because he understood the tension. He said, I'm going to crawl up in his lap and give him a hug, because he is my father. Oftentimes we believe that those two are somehow mutually exclusive, that we have to do one or the other. We can either bow or we can embrace God. Why can't we do both? I believe we can. And I believe that's what God is calling us to and telling us that he is Yahweh. He is high and holy. We should lift him up and hold him in the highest esteem. And yet we ought to realize that he invites us into his throne room of grace and to crawl up into his lap just like we would our own fathers, and to embrace and enjoy the love he has for us. My friends, my brothers and sisters, that is who Yahweh is. He is holy, but he loves you. Let us stand and let us sing.